From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still. Just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone.
Well, if you were listening to President Obama yesterday during his second inaugural address, you heard him refer to the Stonewall riots of 1969. He's reaching out to his gay brothers and sisters and says this is going to be an important agenda for his second term. We here in Massachusetts have had gay marriage since 2003, so it may not seem like such a big deal to us, but it is in many, many other states across the country. You just heard Christina Quinn saying that the state of Rhode Island is taking it up in its legislature. It's in committee today. It's going to supposedly go to a full vote maybe later this week, but it hasn't passed even in Rhode Island yet. So joining me here on the phone are the Reverend Irene Monroe. She's a theologian and writer for the Huffington Post and the New England Blade, and Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. We're also going to take your calls today, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Well, Sue, when we called you earlier today to say we were going to talk about it, you said, oh, that's great, let's move on. But it's easy for us to do that because
Right. We've
had it here for so long that it seems that way. But I was going back and looking at some of the arguments that are going to come up before the Supreme Court, and they are not all so easily dismissible. So it's not like this is just a given.
No, it's not a given. And, some folks have sort of reacted in the, well, it's great the president said something, but what does that mean? And I think it's important to note how the bully pulpit of the office of the Commander-in-Chief of the United States of America has an infinite amount of power. And for his rubber stamp on our movement, for his actually seeing us and identifying us and recognizing the efforts that have been made, makes all the difference in the world, especially to people who are struggling in silence or who are closeted or straight allies who just don't feel like they have the cover to come out and be forceful. When he came out in the summer after Joe Biden helped him along, saying that he personally supported the right of gay couples to marry, and Irene can speak to this at length, it changed the whole dynamic in the African-American community for ministers who had been supportive but were not able to come out and be supportive due to their clergy. So it's a major ground change, and it really does help a lot of states. I mean, we are so far ahead here in Massachusetts and even in New England that there are folks still fighting for just a domestic partnership recognition or the ability to hang a rainbow flag over a bridge in Florida during gay pride. I mean, it's not like it is in Massachusetts everywhere.
It's amazing. I mean, even California doesn't have it. I mean, you refer to it as a rubber stamp. I'd say it was more of an imprimatur. I mean, he really embraced this, not just, brushed it off. So,
absolutely.
Reverend Irene Monroe, tell us your story.
Well, first of all, I just want to say that Obama's speech yesterday was the most inclusive speech a president has ever given. And when he referenced Seneca, Selma, and Stonewall, it was the first time that I felt, as an African-American lesbian, that I'm visible. I'm part of the American fabric. Obama now has...
I had to look up Seneca. I didn't know.
Oh, really?
I didn't know how... I did. Do you know what year it was?
No, I don't.
See?
No, I don't know the
year. Wait a minute. 1920. I know
no,
we got the
it was
right.
1848.
Yeah.
See, now
okay.
I don't feel so bad looking it up. it was before the Emancipation Proclamation, which is pretty amazing.
Well, even before the Civil War, if you
yeah,
go,
it was before
yeah
the
when
Civil
you look
War.
At it. All right. But it's the first time I wanted to say that I felt fully represented, that I'm visible. I'm part of the fold here. And I have to say that Obama now has momentum on his side. So he doesn't have to worry as much as he did before whether black ministers or black activists who are against same-sex marriage, will vote for him or not. This is his last term. So he has nothing to lose and just absolutely everything to gain. But I do want to say this, though. The tide is changing in the African-American community. not fast enough, I would say, to get an overwhelming support from the black community. But it's definitely changing, and we see this more generationally, a younger generation of African-American LGBT youth coming out. Unfortunately, as they're coming out, we're also seeing a greater incidence of homelessness.
When you came out, how did it affect your position as a reverend?
Of course, the church wanted to get rid of me, and the only reason why they kept me because I was at a church. I was at a black Presbyterian church that nobody really wanted the church. So by default, I got the church. And I think also what was very, very interesting, to them, I didn't look like what they would say a homosexual mm-hmm. looked like.
Mm-hmm.
So they could delude themselves with, she's not really one because she puts on a dress.
Now, Sue and Irene, is either one of you married? Because, as I'm sure you know the arguments far better than I do, the English philosopher Bertrand Russell is one of the ones who's often quoted in kind of, not necessarily the anti-gay marriage, but he raises the thought. He says, but for the children, there would be no need of any institution concerned with sex. So that the idea being that because there are children and prodigy means, you know, if you're same sex, you've got a more complicated situation. Let's put it that way.
Well, I'm married.
Okay.
I do have a child, and I can tell you that within her own, my daughter's own colleagues at her middle school, there's a million different combinations of families. So, you know, at this day and age in America to say that...
In Massachusetts.
Well, also in America, I mean, yeah, but it's just so different that it's hard to find a family that looks like every other family. So it's really a non-starter.
Right, and see, my partner and I, we are married, but we are childless. Not animalless, but we definitely are childless.
We're going to take your calls here today, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Not just the issue of gay marriage, gay rights. We've got that here, and we get it here in Massachusetts. But sort of this idea that the president embraced it, and if the president embraces it, will the country follow? I just mentioned that the state of Rhode Island is just taking it up this week. So it's incremental. I think we've got, 11 or 13 states that are totally on board now, Maryland, mm-hmm. and two others came on board just in November. So some of them have been put to a referendum and some of them not. And that's the big issue here, because in some of the precedent-setting cases, they're saying, well, This is precedent set by court, which means that the court has to be the final arbiter, not the people. You know, we didn't let the people decide it here in Massachusetts.
And they shouldn't have to, because, see, I think that's wrongheaded and wronghearted, simply because, just as an African-American, I just think about what would have it been like if we put, you know, should black folks have the right, you know, to be free as a ballot initiative.
Exactly. So we shouldn't put it to the people, right?
No.
You're saying.
But Emily, it doesn't matter how it goes, because they're unhappy with whatever happens. When it's a court decision, they say it's an activist judge. When the representatives vote for it, which are the representatives of the people, they say the judge should decide it. When the people vote for it, they say that it should be decided a different way. The only problem that most anti-gay activists have with gay marriage is the gay part. And every single argument that they have falls apart, you know. And I want to say that about Obama's speech, you know, there was a moment in it when he, which our friend Charlie Pierce, who wrote it, the Esquire blog, he called it Lincolnosity. You know, as soon as Obama uttered the phrase, through blood drawn by lash and blood drawn by sword, you knew this was going to be a totally different speech. This was not going to be a just let's get out there and get them, but let's all acknowledge our roots, let's acknowledge where we came from, and push forward this agenda that you voted me to do. So it was really a stunning moment when those words came out.
It's interesting, because as you both know, he's kind of waffled on this issue. He was for it as a legislator, against it as a senator. Then he said he was evolving. So for him to really just come right out and embrace it. Anyway, we're taking your calls today as well, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We've got Matt in the car. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Just wanted to comment on the Bertrand Russell quote that you just threw out, that is espoused by anti-gay marriage.
Right, that's what I said.
Mm-hmm. To say that, you know, Bertrand Russell's most famous essay is Why I'm Not a Christian. And, you know, his argument was not that only a man and a woman should be married, but that marriage itself was ridiculous. I mean, he was a proponent.
Oh, yeah, but I'm not saying that Bertrand Russell is anti-gay marriage. I'm saying that's what, you know, anti-gay marriage are using that as an example, you know, of a quote, you know, because he's this great English philosopher.
So I'm not saying that he... I mean, he was a proponent of...
No, I know. I understand.
Polygamy, but... you know, he threw that institution right under the bus.
Yeah, but, you know, that doesn't mean people can't extract something to make their argument, and that's what's happened in this case.
I just think that it's funny that the religious right would be the ones pulling a Bertrand Russell quote out and using it to their benefit.
Well, you know, I don't know if it's all the religious right. I mean, I was looking at some of the constitutional things, too, about the Constitution doesn't forbid the government from, you know, preserving marriage in its traditional form. I mean, a lot of what's going to be argued, and I'm no constitutional lawyer. I'm not a lawyer at all, so I don't know how this is going to come down and on what arguments. But I'm sure, you know, whoever argues this is going to argue it on any level possible.
Well, you know, Emily, this is a good point.
Matt, finish up.
Prohibit certain things is almost along the philosophical line of trying to prove a negative.
Yeah.
It just.
Mm-hmm.
Nonsensical.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Go ahead, Sue.
You know, Matt brings up a good point, though, that the argument against marriage of keeping gays out of marriage because it weakens marriage is actually
having the effect
that they expect because they didn't want gays to marry. Gays have chosen civil unions in some areas, and some young people who are straight are saying, wait a minute, why is marriage a government issue?
Yeah.
Why is it that I can't just get a civil union? So by denying gays access to marriage, what they've done is basically weaken marriage, which was against what they originally wanted to do. And, you know, America has this very funny relationship with marriage because of how we were born. In other countries, like in Germany, and our cultural Western cousins, they have a marriage at the city hall, and then they have a wedding or a religious ceremony.
Right, if they want,
different.
Yeah.
Right, so they have too, and many Europeans understand this, but Americans, because...
No, we confuse it. Yeah,
well, When we went west, we sent a minister. That's usually the one person who went west with the group. So the minister's allowed to sign the contract, the government piece of paper that's the license that says that you're married. It's the only piece of paper that a non-government person can sign like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a minister can sign, and it's only because that's who was out in the west. So we have all these traditions that were based on how we were born but aren't necessarily reflective of what our constitutional rights are.
Okay, we're taking your calls today. I'm here on the phone with the Reverend Irene Monroe, who's a theologian and writer for the Huffington Post and the New England Blade, and Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. And we've got Michael on the phone. Go ahead, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
The takeaway for me in what President Obama said yesterday in his speech is that he tied Stonewall to pay inequality for women, to minority in access, you know, the inequality of minorities in this country. And in doing so, it creates an opportunity for all of us to look at gay and lesbians, unfair pay for women, inequality to access to jobs for black men in this country.
Mm-hmm.
To see the similarity, to see how all of these things are connected, and they're all connected by our Constitution, and they're all connected by the fact that as American citizens, we all are guaranteed the right to equal access.
Mm-hmm.
And further, I just also wanted to make the point that though we have had gay marriage in Massachusetts for a long time, we have over 20 states that changed their constitutions to prevent gay and lesbian Americans.
That's right.
Law-abiding, tax-paying American citizens from having the same rights everyone else has.
Yeah, that's still good. You know, I kept wondering, Reverend Irene Monroe, if any group felt left out yesterday. I mean, there are whole groups of people in America who still feel disenfranchised, people that are overweight. I mean, there's a lot of people who feel like they have had, you know, the tide turned against them for one prejudicial reason or another. Do you think this is going to open the floodgates?
Well, you know, interestingly, I was thinking about this and talking with a few folks about Obama's speech just this morning. And one of the things, talking with a couple of African Americans this morning, is still this sort of lingering feeling in the black community that the gay rights movement has moved along much faster and closer to mainstream society than the black civil rights movement. So you still have that kind of lingering and feeling. And one of the ways in which, you know, they'll talk about it is just looking at the prison industrial system, a problem that this country still cannot address equitably around gay, you know, about black men in the penal system. So you'll still have some lingering feelings around that. Again,
although it's been centuries, really, since gay people, you should speak to this before Reverend Irene, but felt comfortable talking about it at all. I mean, being African American was obvious, and you know, we knew there was oppression there, and the whole slave.
And when you divide this though along the race line, even though we have it in Massachusetts, you have disproportionately many, and it's not just about. Of course, you have disproportionately many more white, gay, you know, LGBT folks in Massachusetts, but you don't have African Americans in states with gay marriage is allowed, running to the altar.
Because?
And a lot of that, then, a hesitancy, the way in which, the gay marriage sort of discourse did not include them, or they can't find a link into that kind of discourse to move forward and actually go to the altar.
Mm-hmm. And Emily, what Irene's saying is completely right. When she writes in Bay Window, she's very eloquent about the issues that challenge African American gays and lesbians. And there was and still is racism within the gay community on that issue. We're in many sad ways no better than our straight brothers and sisters on those issues. But at the same time, one of the reasons that gay rights move so quickly is because, as you said, we were able to be invisible, so therefore we could rise to higher levels of power without having to be out, to bear the burden.
But secondly,
because we were also in families, you know, we were sons and daughters and mothers and fathers. So at some point during the HIV crisis, when mothers saw their sons die with no help from the government, with no acknowledgement, it really ignited, a parental urge to bring rights to their kids.
But, you know, Sue, I have to respectfully disagree with you. I mean, with some of that certainly part of the rise is some of what you say, but a lot of it is not to ignore white privilege and the funding.
Yeah.
And the money behind the movement and stuff.
Yeah,
it's not like we were not visible. And clearly, at one point, we were quite invisible in terms of meaning African Americans. But see, one of the things I want to make clear here is that rights around marriage equality can be passed without the support of the black community because of the way in which the discourse and the movement has excluded people of color. So it doesn't matter whether we join in or not.
It's a matter of percentages, too. It's numbers, sheer numbers happen.
Irene's absolutely right. I mean, I might not have presented myself correctly, but I remember the first Human Rights Campaign, which is the largest gay and lesbian political group in America, the first dinner I went to in 1992, was probably 1,200 gays and lesbians in their finest tuxedos and gala wear, and I was overwhelmed by how rich and normal they looked, but they also were overwhelmingly white.
Yeah,
that's part of what moved it forward. Mm-hmm. The white privilege is a bit of the invisibility that I was talking about, that you could be gay and white and just be white.
Taking your calls today, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We have Jeff on the phone. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, Emily. Yeah, I wanted to weigh in and just on the point you said about how we've had gay marriage here in Massachusetts for the last 10 years, and it's somewhat of a non-issue. I think that's an important point of view. As someone who grew up in the American South in Tennessee and then lived there for 25 years and moved here in 2010 and was able to marry my husband, who I now live here with, I think it's an interesting point to make that things haven't fallen apart here in the last 10 years. And because you hear that perception in other parts of the country.
Still, I know.
The president changing the perception, we as people who live in Massachusetts can say, it's not impacting anyone else's marriage. And take it from that point of view.
You know, I agree with you. It doesn't impact anyone's marriage, but it does have profound impact in certain religious communities. I'll give you an example. There was a minister here in Massachusetts who opened his church to African-American LGBT folks and lost a significant number, not only parishioners, but also income. So you're absolutely right. It doesn't per se have any impact on people's individual, marriages, but it will splinter communities in very serious ways.
Absolutely.
Thanks for that, Jeff.
You know, and also the part which I think is hard for grown people to communicate to other grown people is the feeling of rejection. I mean, I was in the room when President Clinton made his address to the Human Rights Campaign, back in, I think, 1994, 96, and just grown men weeping that a president had come to speak to us, openly gay people. And to
to need to have that approval at our grown age.
At this point, yeah.
At this point, it's stunning to say, but when the president included me yesterday, I was moved to tears.
I can imagine.
After, you know, from a campaign of Paul Fongus back in the 90s, where he was the first presidential campaign to reach out to gay people, to this. Yes, it's been very quick, but at the same time, you know, I remember when we were just happy to have a code word, you know, said in a speech that we knew was for us.
Yeah. All right. Been speaking with Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows and the Reverend Irene Monroe, a theologian and writer for the Huffington Post and the New England Blade. Thank you both for being with us.
Well, thank you.
President Obama yesterday. All righty. And Karen Miller is back at Studio 3.
Hey, so you were talking about a big social change that we're witnessing. We're going to be talking about a different kind of change, a sort of upheaval in higher education. What's coming? Are we going to see the disappearance of, you know, quads and exactly, and professors and students? Is everything moving online?
I hope not in Boston.
We'll be talking to the president of Northeastern former president of Tufts.
Yeah. Okay. I'm Emily Rooney.
I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio.